Make sure you can see monitors, everybody. Our next poet is our feature. Our next poet is the first person in Chicago who saw my stuff. She's the first person in Chicago who ever published me. I think she's brilliant.
Word.
He is a talented man.
A lot of us over.
Yeah. She's got websites. She publishes books. The lady is a queen, and she performs like nothing you've ever seen before. Janet Kuipers.
Thank you, and hello. I have this band on my arm specifically because most of the pieces that I'm choosing to just read tonight are about something, someone's death. I know that sounds bad. It could be about the death of the daughter I'll never have, or an ex-boyfriend who didn't know he was dead, or nature and animals that I had no ability to be able to save, or my mother who survived, or Dave who I'm afraid didn't, or to myself, because with every decision I have to make in my life, I usually always have to lose a piece of myself. So these pieces are a little about life and death, and that's why it's called The Cycle of Life. My mother has cancer, and we decided to go across the country for a weekend to visit her. I put it out of my mind until we had to actually fly there. The night before, I couldn't bring myself to pack. It was like 2 a.m. when I finally decided to pull my suitcase off from the pantry shelf. I kept telling people at work, "Well, you see, I have to visit my mother because she has cancer, so I have to miss a few days of work." But I was always able to say it so matter-of-factly until I actually had to visit her. In fact, when my sister told me the diagnosis, it was right around Christmas time, and there was so much work to do, and I still had presents to wrap and a meal to prepare, and Christmas was supposed to be a happy time, that I managed to postpone even thinking about it until I had to pack, to decide what to take, what to leave behind, put my life into a little black box with a handle and wheels, and go. It shouldn't be like this, and I know that. I know it shouldn't be that this where I'm visiting my mother under these circumstances, and I knew she didn't want to hear about bad things because they always make her cry, and this would make her want to cry and cry because the only reason why we're there is because things are bad. But I wasn't supposed to think that way. Things would be just fine. So I finished packing at like 4 a.m, and the next thing I remember is I was on the plane with my sisters, and then we got to Mom and Dad's house, and everyone was so happy to see each other. It was one big family reunion, and we were all laughing and talking and trying to figure out where we were all going to sleep. And the sisters and Dad walked into the front room to see if the couches were good enough to sleep on, and I was alone in the den with Mom. And so I suddenly became serious and sat down next to her and asked her how she was really doing. And that is when she started to cry, saying that the cancer spread. But what she was most concerned with was the fact that she didn't want to spoil the time that we came to visit her with. But what I don't think she understood is that we couldn't have come at a better time, and there was nothing that she could do that would spoil our trip.
Thank you.
I can't leave this funeral that is never seems to end. I can't leave this funeral that, in a way, never started. And all I know is that I have been doing all of the mourning. And is that the way it goes? Is someone mourning for you for too long, and you, the deceased, didn't know anyone would care, and you, the deceased, didn't know that they were dead? So is it just me? Do I feel this alone? Does your spirit rise after the wreckage and you watch from above and see how everyone reacts and see how I cry and see how I suffer? Is this what you're doing to me? And now, after the funeral, and I have to clean up the mess, and I have to put away the flowers, I have to clean up the room, and I have to escort the people out because they don't deserve to be here. I'm the one that cared, and I have to cater to everyone else. Thank you. Getting this image in my head of a little girl, and she has long straight hair, and she's quiet, and she comes up to me and asks me questions, and I am working, but I turn around to answer her, and she sounds really intelligent, and I treat her that way because I want to treat her like an adult, and then I wonder if I'm not spending enough time with her. And so while I'm answering, I turn off my computer and I turn around to her and I continue to look at her. I make a point to make eye contact with her whenever I communicate with her. And so I get up and we walk to the library and I finish answering her question. And as we get to the library, I ask her, is there anything else that she needs to know? Because I want to be the one that tells her the truth. And she says, no. She says she doesn't need anything. And underlyingly, she makes me feel as if she doesn't need me. And I think, I gave birth to that girl. She has to need something from me. And maybe she's a smart girl, and maybe she's learned to do things on her own, and maybe she does the things I had to do all of my life, and maybe she understands more than I ever did. But these are my memories. These are the memories of something that never happened, and will it ever? I always imagined a girl, maybe that's the maternal side of me, being a mom, being female, and knowing women. But I never knew who the father was, and I never got her name whenever I would have these memories. Maybe she never had one. No, he has so many opportunities. He has nothing to lose. Why not come out of the wilderness, attack everything it sees? Kill something, suck the blood out, make him feel alive for once more. Let them try to restrain him. He has nothing to lose. And for now, I can fly to the highest redwood, look out over the world, despise the world that made him be alone, leaving him alone. Who will carry his name? Who will care for him when he is old? Who can he read bedtime stories to? Now I can feel death creeping upon him, closer and closer. He wants to scream. He calls upon nature. The tides rise. Earthquakes shatter homes. He does not feel vindicated. He is lost. And for now, she can swim to the deepest, darkest cave of the Pacific, high from the solitude, swim lower and lower. Can she find where all the other animals of dying species hide? Can she find them? There must be others. They can understand. They can live together at the bottom of the earth. Could they show their pain for their species, share what is left of their love, create a new race? Soon they will be no more, and we will be taking their bones, reassembling them, studying their form, rebuilding their lives, revering them more than we ever did in life. This is what it all becomes. This is what it all boils down to. Study the bones. Study the mistakes. Study the bones. This next piece is called Everything Was Alive and Dying. I had a dream the other night. I walked to a forest, and there were neatly paved bicycle paths, and trash cans every 50 feet, and trash every 10. And then I saw a raccoon with a few little baby raccoons following her. It was so cute. I wish I had my camera. And she spoke to me, and she said, "Thank you for not buying furs. I know you humans are pretty smart. You've got to be able to figure out a way to keep yourselves warm without killing me." And I said, "You know they don't do it for warmth. They do it for fashion. They do it for power." And she said, "I know, but thank you anyway." Then I walked a little further, and there was a stray cat. She still had a little neon collar on with a little bell, and she walked a few feet. She stretched her front paws. Oh, it was so darling. And then she walked right up to me, and she said, "Thank you." And I said, "For what?" And then she just looked at me for a moment. Her little ears were standing straight up. And she said, "You know, in some countries, I'm considered a delicacy." And I said, "How do you know of these things?" And she said, "When somebody eats one of you, word gets around." And then she said, "And in some countries, the cow is sacred. Wouldn't they love to see how you humans prepare them for slaughter? How you hang them upside down and slit their throats so they're still beating hearts or drain out of the blood for you?" And I said, don't put me in that category. I don't eat meat." And she said, "I know." And I walked deeper into the forest, heard the crackling of fallen leaves under my steps. The wind tunneled through as it flew past the bark and leaves. I walked, listened to the crack of dead branches under my feet, and I could hear the trees speak to me. And they said, "Thank you for letting the endangered animals live here amongst us. We do think they are so pretty, and it would be a shame to see them go. And thank you for recycling. Thank you for recycling paper, because you're saving us for just a little while longer. We've been on this planet for so long, embedded in the earth. We do have souls, you know. We cling with our roots. We don't want to let go." And I said, but I don't do much. I don't do enough." And they said, "We know. But we'll take what we can get." And I woke up in a sweat. So
So tell me, Bob Dole. So tell me, Pepe Gannis. So tell me, Newt Gingrich. So tell me, Jesse Helms. If you woke up from that dream, would you be in a sweat too? Do you even know why we should save the rainforest? Oh, preserve the delicate balance. Just tear the whole forest down. What difference does it make? Put in some orange groves, or a concentrate orange juice can be a little cheaper. Did you know that medical researchers have a very, very hard time trying to come up with synthetic cures for diseases on their own? It helps a lot if they can first find a substance in nature. And a tree that appears in a rainforest may be the only one of its kind, or one like it may be 2 miles away instead of right next to it. I wonder how many cures we've destroyed to plant more orange groves. Serves us right. You know, my motives aren't selfless. I know that these things are worthwhile in my life. I'd like to find a cure to these diseases before I die of them, and I'm not just a vegetarian because I think it's wrong to kill an animal unless I have to. I also know the excess protein pulls the calcium away from my bones and gives me osteoporosis, and the excess fat gives me heart attacks, and I also know that we could be feeding 10 times more people with the same resources used for meat production. You know, I know you're looking at me and calling me an extremist. But I'm sitting here, looking around me, looking at the destruction caused by family values, and thinking at the right, moral, non-violent decisions are also those extreme ones. Everything is linked here. We destroy our animals, we destroy our plants, we destroy our earth, we're even destroying our air. We wreak havoc on the soil, on the atmosphere. We dump our waste into our lakes. We pump aerosol cans and exhaust pipes. And you tell me, I am extreme. And I'm beginning to think that we just keep doing it because we don't know how to stop. And deep inside, we feel the pain of all that we've killed. And we try to control it by popping a chemical-filled painkiller. We live through the guilt by taking caffeine, nicotine, morphine. And we keep ourselves thin with saccharin. And we keep ourselves sane with our alcohol poisoning. And when that's not enough, maybe a line of coke. Maybe shoot ourselves in the head in front of the mirror in the master bedroom. Or maybe just take some pills, walk into the garage, turn on the car, and just fall asleep. In the wild, you have no power over anyone else. Now that we're civilized, we create our own wild. Maybe when we have all this power, the only choice we have is to destroy ourselves. And so we do. You jumped from an airplane once, and you promised that you'd force me to go with you the next time. You were always jumping out of airplanes, weren't you? The ring I'm wearing is on my right hand, not my left, and it's on my middle finger, not my ring finger, and it seemed appropriate that you didn't even buy me that ring, and we weren't even married. I bought the ring at a street fair on Belmont Avenue in Chicago on the day of our first date, where we later watched Pulp Fiction at your apartment, and I asked you to sit closer to me, and you kissed me. The ring isn't a complete circle. There are 2 stones that don't quite meet, and there's a void in the middle, and that was appropriate because you didn't even buy it for me, and we weren't even married. I miss you, you know. I can't even pass an apartment building you live in anymore.
I remember once that you told me that someone was shot in that building once, and maybe it was haunted. But they were shot for money. They were robbed. And this time, you just slipped away in your sleep. And this time, I was robbed. When one of the stones fell out of that ring, I was sad, but I think that you were more sad. You wanted to replace that shiny purple stone, but I said no. And now I still wear that ring, and the stone is still missing, and isn't it appropriate? And we weren't even married. I've missed you, you know, and with your absence, the bad memories vanish. So with this ring, I remember, because now nothing is complete anymore, and everything is missing now. And isn't it appropriate that there's no next time for us? You jumped from an airplane once, and you promised that you'd force me to go with you the next time. It is winter now. The trees have lost their leaves. The city is covered in a thin layer of soot and snow. The grass is dead. In the sunless sky, black birds circle overhead, searching for prey. And eerie cold settles over everything. Nothing is growing anymore. Death takes many forms. For you, death first came when you were 5 years old, and your mother had to give you 3 shots of insulin a day until you could take a needle to yourself. Did it hurt you to push that needle into your arm the first time? Or did it hurt you more to know that you had no choice? Death takes many forms. Death can be someone telling you without trying that they're losing their sight. Behind Coke bottle glasses, you would see me and say, "That's a nice black suit you're wearing." And I would tell you, "It's green." And you wouldn't believe me. You wouldn't hear the howling wind of the changing season. Death takes many forms. I know what follows the autumn wind. It is winter now. Do you remember when it happened? The changes are subtle. The temperature drops first only slightly. It's almost imperceptible. Only when the first snow falls do you realize where the seasons have gone. Death takes many forms. Death can be a sweat-soaked shirt, the shakes, dizziness when you needed food. You would look as pale as a ghost as I would hold your cold, wet arm and study you. Quick, some sugar will make everything better. Isn't everything better yet? Death takes many forms. The signs of death can come when you first lose your circulation. "My feet are numb, Janet," you'd say. "I can't feel my feet anymore." And I would rub your feet for you, and you would say it makes a difference. You feel better. If only I could do this forever. Death takes many forms. I said goodbye to you to travel my own road. I didn't think it would be the last goodbye. How was I to know? When I left, I knew you didn't want me to go. And now it's my turn. Why are we always saying goodbye to each other? Are you trying to teach me a lesson? Because if you are, well, I've learned it. Trust me, I have. You can come back now.
Death takes many forms, and now it seems you're taking me down with you. You've taken me into that casket with you, and I'm running my hand along your jacket lapel, and I can feel the coldness of winter all around me, and I can hear them shoveling the dirt over my head, and I want to get out, and I want to take you with me. Death takes many forms. Death can be that hole you left, you know, right over here, just a little to the left. I keep wondering when the pain will go away, when everything will be better. You once showed me that winter could be beautiful. Instead of the dark and dirty snow lacing the city streets, you showed me a quieting snowfall over a lake at your parents' backyard, glistening in an untouched whiteness. I told you I hated winters, and you told me, this you don't hate. Well, I'm still learning. It is winter now, and death takes many forms. The seasons change for you and I. It is snowing, and something is ending. It is snowing. Somewhere, it is snowing. I'm a record now. You know how vinyl goes. There's that ridge, trailed in circles, that groove that the needle can easily slip into. Well, I feel like I'm that record now, and that needle of life is in me, and it's playing my story, and I'm stuck on this record playing at a certain speed, and I can't get the needle out of the groove, and my life is being played out for me for everyone to hear and see and live, and they don't feel a goddamn thing, but they claim to know how I feel. But that needle is stuck in there, and that RPM is set on that certain speed at that player, and now my life is an open book, and my life is now a playing record. And people can choose to read the book, and people can choose to listen to the music. And sometimes that excites me, sometimes that fascinates me, and sometimes that scares me. Because I wonder if people who listen know too little or too much.